Hey y'all, how's it going? Welcome to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. I got a good one lined up for you today, too. Sorry I was out last week. I was out of town. But anyway, now I'm back. And man, there's a bunch of stuff happened while I was gone and I didn't get to radio about it. It was really frustrating because, you know me, I like talking about stuff that I like talking about. I like it a lot. So, today is going to be my chance to catch up on that and some of the interviews that I wasn't able to get last week either. First of all, the interviews. Today we will have Nancy Yosef from McClatchy Newspapers. And, you know, I thought I'd interviewed her once or twice. No, I guess not. But anyway, I've been reading her for a long, long time. I got a really good stable of hard news journalists there at McClatchy. A little bit outside of the, at least the elitist end of the mainstream anyway. They do good work there, and she's got some news about Libya we're going to be talking about. Phil Giraldi will be here. We got four different important subjects to cover on the Phil Giraldi interview today. I don't know if we'll get to them all. But he's written a lot of good stuff lately. And he's writing for this thing, UNZ.org now. Ron Unz site, UNZ. Is it org or com? I think it's org. No, it's com. I'm stupid. UNZ.com, UNZ, UNZ.com. And he's got this one, Why Remain in Afghanistan, for example. And of course, Phil, he's former CIA, so he's going to have something to say about this story about Robert Levinson, the contract CIA employee missing former FBI agent. And of course, it was recently revealed in the last week, an Associated Press piece followed up by a New York Times piece that he was CIA and not just a businessman on a cigarette smuggling case or whatever they tried to say. So Phil's going to give us the real story there. And then, of course, also he wrote a great one about Palestine. See, I'm going through my notes here writing down. Don't forget to ask him about Palestine because there was that one about Palestine. Oh, and about debunking the terror war. You know, Phil does a good job every year of keeping track of the government's official report on terrorism. It's the state and the Defense Department and I guess the intelligence agencies work together on it or something. And he always says, hey, look, even according to their own numbers, they're a bunch of liars, you know? So, yeah. Oh, that's important, you know? I always like to have a former CIA officer on the show to tell you that terrorism is no big deal, not like they make it out to be anyway. And so that's what Phil thinks. He'll be on the show to talk about that. And then Dan McAdams from the Ron Paul Institute of Peace and Prosperity. For Peace and Prosperity? I like of, too. The Ron Paul Institute of Peace and Prosperity. What do you guys think? To or of? Anyway. RPI. I like Dan McAdams. He's going to be on the show. Ron Paul's former foreign policy advisor from his congressional office. And he's been on a tear. And he's actually, he had some great guest writers over there at RPI, too. Really good write-up on who's who among the jihadists in Syria. And he's written one on Syria himself, so Syria, and also we're going to be speaking with him about Ukraine. He wrote a great one about, man, the U.S. empire never does lay down and take a nap for a minute, does it? Not a minute. So Dan McAdams. So, there's 5 minutes on what you're going to hear later. And now, minutes on things I'm not going to interview anybody about, but are extremely important to catch up on. First of all, go to fff.org and look at the fact that there's a conference on the weekend of February the 15th and 16th. It may be just one day, I don't know. Anyway, it's the Students for Liberty. And it's in Washington, D.C., February the 15th is Saturday. And on that day, John Glazer, former editor of Antiwar.com, and myself will be giving a presentation, Libertarianism versus the Empire. John on libertarianism, me on the Empire, and a little bit of both. Always the opposite, too. So, that should be a fun speech, and it's going to be a great thing. Jacob Hornberg is calling it a conference within a conference, and Oliver Stone is going to be speaking. And his partner, I forgot the guy's name, but the guy that he worked on his alternative history of the United States that ran on HBO or Showtime or whatever it was. I didn't see it. But Bob Higgs is going to be there and Sheldon Richman, which, hey, drop everything. Bob Higgs is going to be there. What else do you need to know? But Sheldon Richman and Jacob Hornberger and I'm sorry I don't have it in front of me, man. I should have it in front of me. It's going to be really good, though. I'll be talking about it a lot more coming up. But that's a whole Future Freedom Foundation conference within a conference at the Students for Liberty thing in Washington, D.C., February the 15th. And I'll be giving a talk there with John Glazer. All right. And then also, if you go to ScottHorton.org, the new and improved ScottHorton.org, there's now an Amazon link. And literally, I'm not even lying. This is actually a true thing. People came to me saying, hey, isn't there a way that I can shop on Amazon but click your link first so that you get a cut? You know, like antiwar.com and lewrockwell.com do. And I says, let me get back to you on that. And then my genius webmaster, Dave, he hooked it up. So now if you go to scotthorton.org and you look on the right side, the right column there, the very top link is the Amazon link. So by all means, feel free to do all of your Christmas shopping or whatever the hell you get from amazon.com on there. Just go to scotthorton.org first. And I will get a slight cut. And that'll help pay these bills. Cool. And then also, if you like hearing me talk, then you should listen to my interview on the Freedom Fiends show from yesterday. It's freedomfiends.com. Michael W. Dean. And I was sort of filling in for Nima Vedati. It was more like Dean was interviewing me. But I was supposedly co-hosting, but really he was interviewing me. He was just asking really broad questions like, so, what's going on in the Middle East the last 1,000 years or so? Or, you know, stuff like that. So, I basically just did my best to debunk the terror war. That's all it is me talking for 2 hours, debunking the terror war. It's at freedomfiends.com if you want to hear me on the other end of the interview there. So, check that out. All right, now, Afghanistan. I can't believe this. I mean, really? I have a real problem with this. And you know me, I'm pretty used to this kind of stuff, and my outrage-o-meter's, you know, a little bit bent, if not all the way broken at this point. But man, oh man, this to me, this is like a needle scratching off the record. Everybody stop. Like, general strike for a day so that everyone can just stare at this headline with their jaw hanging open and just realize what kind of country you're living in, what kind of government you're living under. This is a real thing that happened, okay? I'm not lying. This is from the Washington Times. Oh, I know what you're thinking, but they're not lying either. From the Washington Times, Obama's Afghanistan experts stumped on U.S. death toll, war costs, during hearing. Now, I only saw this in the Washington Times. I did not, watch cable news all day that day. I didn't watch the nightly news with Brian Williams or whoever does the nightly news anymore. I don't know if this made TV or not. I guess it didn't. That would be my assumption, that it did not make the TV news. But dig this from the Washington Times from December the 12th. President Obama's brain trust on Afghanistan does not know how much the U.S. spends on the war each year, or the American cost in lost lives on the battlefield. This embarrassing lack of basic knowledge from State Department and Pentagon experts on Afghanistan at a House hearing Wednesday prompted even a Democrat to say he was stunned. The setting was the House Foreign Affairs Committee. The issue, Afghanistan and the transition to fewer U.S. troops post-2014. The witnesses, James F. Dobbins, the State Department's Special Representative to Afghanistan and Pakistan. Donald Sampler, Assistant to the Administrator, U.S. Agency for International Development, USAID, which provides civilian foreign aid. And Michael Dumont, Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for Afghanistan, Pakistan, and Central Asia. When it came time for Dana Rohrabacher, good old Dana Rohrabacher, huh? Give that man some acid. When it came time for Dana Rohrabacher, California Republican, to quiz the witnesses, he asked what he thought was a simple question. Quote, Rohrabacher, to the Obama-Afghanistan war runners. How much are we spending annually in Afghanistan? How much is the cost to the American taxpayer? Which, that's the same question twice, but he just thought he'd throw a taxpayer in there. What's the cost of the Afghan war? He was met with stone silence from the witness panel. Mr. Dobbins gestured to the other witnesses for the answer. They, too, came up empty. Anybody know? Mr. Rohrabacher asked. Nobody knows the total budget, what we're spending in Afghanistan. It's a hearing on Afghanistan. Can I have an estimate? He pleaded. I'm sorry, Congressman, Mr. Dobbins said. Mr. Rohrabacher called the lack of an answer disheartening. Well, how many killed and wounded have we suffered in the last 12 months? He asked. Again, none of the three had an answer. Mr. Dumont said he would get back to him. We're supposed to believe you fellows have a plan that is going to end up in a positive way in Afghanistan? The congressman said. Holy cow! Representative Gerald Connolly, a Virginia Democrat, said he was stunned. I say to the panel, Mr. Rohrabacher is right. How can you come to a congressional oversight hearing on this subject with your titles and not know how much we're spending every year and not know how many casualties we incurred in this last year? I will say to the chairman of this committee, it is actually a stunning, stunning development. Story continues. According to the Pentagon's fiscal 2013 budget is spending about $88 billion this year to wage the war in Afghanistan. The State Department budget allocates $4.6 billion in aid and operations. The U.S. has lost the lives of 118 service members this year, according to iCasualties.org. From the Washington Times. Can you believe that? Is that just me? And Dana Rohrabacher? And I'm sorry to be all hyperbolic and this and that and yelling and screaming and my hair on fire, but I think that the president and his entire cabinet should have to resign over this. Is there no accountability whatsoever? Never mind Obamacare. Never mind all the drone strikes blowing up little babies. Just this, just in a vacuum, just forget everything else for the sake of argument. I'm not saying it doesn't matter. I'm just saying, isn't just this the fact that his men running the war couldn't even give you a guess of how many American soldiers died in or and or Marines died in the war in the last year in Afghanistan. Doesn't that mean that they should all have to quit? Doesn't that mean that they should all be made to quit? I mean, I don't know. I don't know. Maybe, you know, if you'd asked George Bush's men, they would have been, you know, if you caught them by surprise like that, maybe they wouldn't have known either. But geez, I don't know. I think they would have had a guess, right? I don't know. Did anybody ever ask Doug Feith how many American soldiers died in the war? Anyway, not to make it a partisan thing. I just think that's absolutely incredible, you know? What's so hard about, a little bit over 100, I think, sir? 120 or so, Mr. Congressman, sir? They don't even know that. To say that. The men running the war. Oh well. Anyway, on to the next story, everybody. Who cares? Nobody's going to resign. Nobody's in trouble. It's just one little article in the Washington Times. Hey, did you see that? The Democrats don't even know how many 19-year-old kids got their guts blown up to death that they sent there in the last 12 months. Don't even have a guess. On to the next story, I guess. Iran. This is the biggest deal in the whole world. Obama put sanctions on Iran. He's in the middle of telling the Senate, don't put sanctions on Iran. Well, apparently he told them, look, if you don't put sanctions on Iran, I'll put some more on Iran for you. Great plan. So that led to the Iranians pulling out of the talks, which there are constant talks in the background on the lower level, on the technical level, on the implementation level, and they went home. And it was sort of a, you know, international diplomatic temper tantrum thing, which they had to write, you know, the right to throw that they had to throw. What are they going to do? And then I say we all thank our lucky stars that the political situation inside Iran at this point is still far enough in favor of Rouhani. Call him the Iranian Barack Obama in his honeymoon 100 days when everybody still likes him and he's able to get away with a little bit of stuff. He's saying, we press on. Come on, we got to stay within these talks. And they're smart to do that, too. And in fact, you can see how politically immediately they are the bigger man. Oh, I see how you are, Americans. Make a deal that you won't put in on any more sanctions and then add some more sanctions. But you know what? That's cool. That's cool. That's how they're playing it. Good for them. Thank you, Iranian Ayatollah theocracy of backwards totalitarianism, for helping to short-circuit America's attempt to short-circuit diplomacy between your regime and this one. Thank you. No one in Washington, D.C. is as calm or prudent. So the talks continue. What's his name? Zarif put out a thing on his Facebook page. Isn't this great? Living in the future. It's so funny. Zarif put a thing on his Facebook page saying, nope, we're going back to the talks. You're trying to be a jerk and get us to quit talking with you, but it's not going to work. Thank you, Iran. And Barack Obama, these Democrats, I don't know. And then, you know, Harry Reid says he's going to let the Senate vote on more sanctions, which the House has already passed in January. So the Congress, the Israelis, through their control of our Congress, may just destroy this deal yet. I guess we'll see. Be right back. Hey, y'all, Scott here. Man, I had a chance to have an essay published in the book Why Peace, edited by Mark Gutman, but I didn't understand what an opportunity it was. Boy, do I regret I didn't take it. This compendium of thoughts by the greatest anti-war writers and activists of our generation will be remembered and studied long into the future. You've got to get Why Peace. You've got to read Why Peace. It features articles by Harry Brown, Robert Naiman, Fred Bronfman, Dahlia Wasfi, Richard Cummings, Karen Kotowski, Butler Schaefer, Kathy Kelly, Robert Higgs, Anthony Gregory, and so many more. Why peace? Because war is the health of everything wrong with our society. Get Why Peace down at the bookshop or Amazon.com. Just click the book in the right margin at scotthorton.org.
Fact. The new NSA data center in Utah requires 1.7 million gallons of water every single day to operate. Billions of Fourth Amendment violations need massive computers and the water to cool them. That water is being supplied by the state of Utah. Fact. There's absolutely nothing in the Constitution which requires your state to help the feds violate your rights. Our message to Utah? Turn it off. No water equals no NSA data center. Visit offnow.org.
Why does the U.S. support the tortured dictatorship in Egypt? Because that's what Israel wants. Why can't America make peace with Iran? Because that's not what Israel wants. And why do we veto every attempt to shut down illegal settlements on the West Bank? Because it's what Israel wants. Seeing a pattern here? Sick of it yet? It's time to put America first. Support the Council of the National Interest at councilforthenationalinterest.org and push back against the Israel lobby and their sock puppets in Washington, D.C. That's councilforthenationalinterest.org.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back. I'm Scott Horton. This is the show, The Scott Horton Show. I forgot to join up the chat room. So I'm gonna now. You want to join up the chat room? Go to scotthorton.org/chat. And, man, they make these captchas so hard I can't read them. Is that an N? I don't know. So, scotthorton.org/chat. I just signed in, I think. Yeah, here I am. Hey, everybody. Welcome to the show. Coming up, Nancy Youssef on some doings in Libya that you're going to want to hear about. All right. The budget. Let me just mention real quick the coolest thing I've ever seen on military spending ever. It's by Dave Gilson, senior editor at Mother Jones Magazine. Yep, that's the liberals. But it's all right, because guess what? This is the best thing anybody ever put together on military spending. And it's bright and shiny and has colors and lines and cool things to click on and letters in bold and stuff. And so it's, you know, it's kind of catchy. I think you'll like it. I think that you'll like to pass it on to people who might not usually be interested in this kind of thing, but might be able to have their attention held through to the end. Well, I didn't know that. And I like the way $400 billion is all in big orange letters like that. And, wow, one F-35 costs that much, huh? And you can't fly it under what conditions now? And it's, I think you'll like it. I might be overselling it a little bit, but it just seems like the kind of thing that more people would be interested in than would usually be interested in something like military spending, you know? It's called Can't Touch This. The wars are winding down. It's the age of austerity, but nobody messes with the Pentagon budget. And, yeah, so take a look at that. It's $1 trillion a year, you know. $1 trillion a year. You know what's funny is you think about Bill Hicks' whole thing about, it's the most common thing he ever said, really, right, is the end of Sane Man, which he did this a lot, I guess. He'd say, hey, if we took all the money that we spend on all the smart bombs and all of that kind of stuff, and we spent that money feeding and clothing people, you know, so that they're okay, then we could all be one and explore outer space and whatever. And the thing about it is if you take his words literally, even though he sort of sounds like he's implying you know, the government would spend that money. He doesn't really say that. If you just take his words for exactly what they say, he could have meant that in a completely free market capitalist sense. Just how about abolish all taxation and all statism altogether and let the people of the world feed and clothe the people of the world? Save all those trillions of dollars, not just the ones wasted on America's militarism. And the thing is, of course, the argument is, but it's a dangerous world out there. But the truth is that, no, it's not. That's stupid. You know, come on. We don't have any enemies, really, in the world. It's that stateless, definitionless band of suicide bombers that we accidentally back half the time and outright back the other half. So, come on. Bill Hicks is right. And in fact, I completely failed the quiz about how much do you know about the world the other day, because it wasn't about America's wars and stuff like that. It was all questions of what percent of the world is literate? What percent of them have clean drinking water on a daily basis? And what percentage of them make, you know, at least this much money a day versus only that much? And whatever. And the thing is that I was underestimating how well the world was doing on almost every question. And I kind of knew better than this, if only because I read John Mueller. And John Mueller wrote that great book, Overblown, about how, oh yeah, everything terrible is such a big deal if you watch American TV. But in real life, the UN's running out of peacekeeping troops because there's ceasefires breaking out everywhere. And autocrats and hereditary dictators and whatever are at the fewest number they've ever been, ever, ever. And the lowest peasants have the most rights ever. And no, we're a long way from perfect, but if we would really just knock off all the worst stuff we're doing, we meaning, you know, everybody. If humanity would knock off the worst stuff, we would do so much better on, and I mean by that, I mean the militarism, of course. We would do so much better at curing questions of poverty and deprivation and whatever in ways that don't even require coerced charity. The people who are willing to be charitable will be rich enough that they'll be able to cover the gap. All we need is liberty, that's all, you know. And to read about $1 trillion wasted on this Pentagon and its empire, it's just, it's like you wouldn't believe it, man. If you were Kangen Kodos and you just got here, you'd be going, nuh-uh. The Americans did not let the Defense Department hijack their entire economy and bend it toward its purpose in this way, unchecked for this many years in a row. Come on. No way. Go look at it. It's Mother Jones. The budget deal is a big win for the Pentagon. Of course it is. The kind of money, the kind of things they're wasting your money on, you'll believe it, and but you won't want to. You know? All right. And then, man, I'm going way too slow to cover all this stuff. Music's going to play in just a minute here. Yemen. Drone strike killed 17 people in a wedding party. I know you couldn't smell their burning corpses from here, but believe me, to them, it was real. And to the survivors, man, those burns were really hot, and they gotta remember that. And the pieces of all their loved ones around. Imagine being, having pieces of your blown up loved ones all over you. And have to scrape it off. That's how America does things. That's how our government handles what they call business. That's a surgical strike, you see. I don't know. You ever have someone you love die peacefully in their sleep of natural causes because they were really old? Remember how sad that was? Yeah. No. Do I gotta keep extrapolating for you how traumatic it might be if somebody blew them up? The Americans did it with a drone. That's going on. McAdams on Syria coming up, Yosef on Libya, China messing around in the South China Sea. They say, anyway, an American battleship and a Chinese battleship of some kind. I don't know all their definitions of which ships they were, but military ships on both sides, Navy ships, they had to go to evasive maneuvers to avoid collision. You know, because the South China Sea is an American lake, right? Isn't that how that's supposed to work? Ready for a war with China over nothing? Not me either. Hey, Al Scott here for MyHeroesThink.com. They sell beautiful 7-inch busts of libertarian heroes, Ludwig von Mises, Murray Rothbard, Ron Paul, and Harry Brown. I've got the Harry Brown one on the bookshelf now. Makes me smile every time it catches my eye. These finely crafted statues from MyHeroesThink.com make excellent decorations for your desktop at work, bookends for your shelves, or gifts for that special individualist in your life. They're also all available in colors now, too. Of course, gold, silver, or bronze. Coming soon, Hayek, Hazlitt, Carlin. Use promo code Scott Horton and save $5 at MyHeroesThink.com. Hey, all, Scott Horton here for The Future of Freedom, the monthly journal of the Future Freedom Foundation. As you may already be aware, Jacob Hornberger, Sheldon Richman, and James Bovard are awesome. They're also in every issue of The Future of Freedom, and they're joined by others of the best of the libertarian movement. People like Anthony Gregory, Wendy McElroy, Lawrence Vance, Joe Stromberg, and many more. Even me. Sign up for The Future of Freedom at fff.org/subscribe. It's just $25 a year for the print edition, $15 to read it online. That's The Future of Freedom, edited by Sheldon Richman at fff.org/subscribe. And tell you heard it here. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. Website is scotthorton.org. Keep all my interview archives there. We're live 3 to 5 Eastern Time at libertyexpressradio.com. And our first guest on the show today is Nancy Yosef from McClatchy Newspapers. Welcome to the show. How are you doing?
I'm doing great, thanks.
I appreciate you joining us today, live on the phone from Cairo. I've been reading your stuff for a long, long time. Happy to finally get you on the show here.
Oh, wonderful. Thank you.
And it's a pretty big blockbuster story you have here about the goings-on at the Benghazi airport in Benghazi, Libya. Is that right?
That's right.
And so who's training who? and what are they training them to do?
Well, basically, since Chris Stevens, the U.S. ambassador to Libya, and three Americans were killed in September of 2012, Ansar Sharia, which is the group, the Islamist jihadist group whose members are believed to have been involved in that attack, have expanded their hold on eastern Libya. So where they established themselves in Benghazi at the time of the ambassador's death, they've now expanded into other eastern cities and control the security and other buildings in eastern Libya. And now it seems that they're using the instability and the ungoverned space that is eastern Libya to bring in trainers from as far away as Syria and train them on jihadist Islamist practices. And what I was able to learn while I was from the airport was that that people were flying from as far as Syria, which was new in the sense that we knew that people were coming in from neighboring Algeria and Tunis, but the idea that people were coming in as far as Syria was what was so shocking, that people were actually flying in to Libya to be trained and then take that training back to the war in Syria.
Okay, and then, well, and it's really important too, I guess, from as far from there as Algeria they're coming to, but now what exactly does it mean that they're being trained in jihadist practices there?
Well, our feeling, my sense of it from on the ground was that that people are coming to Libya in the case of Syria because they felt that the Libyans were successful in overthrowing their dictator and they were looking for techniques, tactics, military tactics, leadership tactics from their jihadi counterparts in Libya, because they felt that they were successful in their fight against the dictator. And that they could take those practices back to Syria. The significance is that you have jihadist training to take over countries rather than the sort of democratic revolutionaries that we first thought of when Arab Spring began in 2011.
Right, and I mean, you could even include the Muslim Brotherhood with the Democrats in that, if you want to split it that way, right?
And it depends on who you ask in Egypt. I mean, in Egypt, there are people who feel that the Muslim Brotherhood, which is the biggest secretive organization here, one of the biggest organizations both in terms of policy and social movement, as a group that hijacked a democratic movement. Now, it depends on who you ask. There are revolutionaries here who feel like the Brotherhood hijacked what they were trying to start here. And there are others who feel that the Brotherhood actually went through the very democratic system that the revolutionaries were proposing, and that their frustration is that they lost at the very system that they were trying to bring into place.
Yeah, but even as far as who's who and what they're training to do, I guess, and, you know, what do I know? I've never been to Egypt, but my sense has been that the Muslim Brotherhood, just being that they're older and wealthier people, property owners and members of the elite, and or at least kind of the upper middle class, that they're kind of by definition conservatives and not radicals. And they did try, they
That's
did
right.
get elected after all, rather than wage some jihad
That's right.
or something like that.
That's right. And you raise a great point, because a lot of times people think of brotherhood because they're conservative or because their supporters are beneficiaries of the social rationing that they do, that they're somehow uneducated. But in fact, to become a brotherhood member is a very expensive process. Just to be initiated in is a 7-year process. And so while their supporters may be poor and illiterate, in terms of membership and organization, it's made up of people usually who are very well educated and part of the economic elite of the countries that they live in.
Right. And so, but now the guys in Benghazi, now here's the thing too, and I'm trying to think back, I'm not certain, I'm sure you probably were on top of this all along anyway, but of course Patrick Coburn and many others back in 2011 were reporting that... basically, where the guys we're fighting this war for, the air war, is air cover for, you know, what are basically the Libyan veterans of the recent Iraq war, where they were fighting. The Americans certainly would have just accused them all of being Zarqawiites, right? Members of al-Qaeda in Iraq. They were Libyans who traveled to Iraq to fight the Americans and the Shiites that the Americans were fighting for there. And then they turned right around and they were fighting for these guys all along, right?
Well, there's a city in eastern Libya called Darna, which had proportion to its population, more people go to Iraq and Afghanistan and fight than any other city in the Middle East. And it's obviously a very conservative Islamist area. And so there was a lot of concern that by removing Gaddafi, who had tried to put a lid on them for his own interests, of course, to protect his own power, not for any interest of the United States, That by removing Gaddafi, that there was a potential of unleashing those elements into Libya. And I think that's the concern now, because that appears to be happening. Because while most Libyans and the National Democratic Institute just put out a poll that found that the vast majority are against these groups and want their government to succeed, the government is incredibly inexperienced and nascent, and this is a country that's never had a real security force that can properly fend off these groups who, as you say, have members who have trained in Iraq and Afghanistan. And so that was the concern when the United States and its NATO allies intervened to stop Benghazi, to stop Gaddafi from overrunning Benghazi and eventually contributing to his downfall.
All right. Now, as far as the different tribes, I don't know if you know what they all are and all their different relative power structures and whatever, but I wonder, is there an overall sense among the population that, hey, we're all Libyans and we all kind of have at least some kind of unity? I don't want to praise nationalism, but you understand what I mean, that,
yeah.
you know, rather yeah. than, nope, it's the Hatfields versus the McCoys here and that's how it's going to stay, we break back into at least three pieces and that kind of madness. Because that, of course, would be violence, everybody stuck on the wrong side of the lines and all that stuff.
No, I think it's... Because when you do go to Libya, it's really, as you mentioned, Libya is a relatively new state, and it's not they're not organic borders in the sense of rivers and stuff dividing it. It was three sections, one in the east, one in the south, and one in the west. And when you go to each area, it really does feel distinctive. At one point, the east, which is where Ansar Sharia and a lot of these jihadi groups are operating out of, had tried to create its own sort of state within Libya and separate itself quite formally from the rest of the country. And so those divisions have always been there. They've been a defining part of Libya, and they continue to be there. So the divide that I see is not so much tribal but regional, because they really do feel like three very distinct parts of Libya. And that was only aggravated under Gaddafi, because he tended to fund the western part more, all the way up to Sirte, which was his hometown. And so those tensions remain in place. And the fact that these jihadists are operating from there really further only isolates them from places like Tripoli, which has so resoundingly rejected them and are trying to bolster their government, which is also not only advantageous to Libya, but to their own power structure because they would retain control of the country in the capital. Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, it wasn't very long at all after the fall of Tripoli back in 2011. It may have even still been in 2011 or at least early in 2012 were the first reports of Libyans hopping on boats and hopping on planes and taking off to Syria to go fight in that one, where, again, America's on the side of the revolutionaries against the dictatorship. And there was at least that Sunday Times report about the different factions fighting over the ship full of guns that had come from, I don't know, somewhere in Libya anyway. I just wonder, you know, whether, and I guess, I don't know what the sources were, but people said that that was part of what Ambassador Stevens and his mission was all about there in Benghazi, was helping to coordinate the exporting of the revolution on to the next one.
Well, my sense, I've spent quite a bit of time in Libya, and I started to see a turn a few months after Gaddafi was killed in October of 2011. It was really born out of the insecurity and instability because nobody controlled the country. I was in Libya at the time with the United States intervened, and I think the feeling was that the Libyan rebels were organized, that this was a small state, an oil-rich state that had the potential. The majority of people wanted Gaddafi removed and were against the militias, and I think all that led people to believe that the momentum was on the side of those who wanted a democratic Libya to rise. My experience was that we started to see a turnaround in early 2012 as the instability seeped in, and as the you know, Libyans were united around getting rid of Gaddafi, and once that was gone, the division started to emerge, and militant elements, as you say, began traveling back and forth to countries, and the floodgates sort of opened up for all, not only people leaving, but also groups. Members coming in from neighboring countries where they could survive as well as they could in an ungoverned space like Libya.
Mm-hmm. And now these guys that are training right now, these Ansar al-Sharia guys at the airport and all that, are they training in target practice and bomb making and that kind of thing too?
We don't know. That's the assumption, but it's very hard to know. And in fact, when I asked the government, they didn't themselves. The Prime Minister Zaidan of Libya says that they stay for about 2 days, but this government has such a hard time just conducting basic security that developing the intel to really understand what's happening has proven to be very difficult for them. So I have yet to see anybody to offer any clear explanation of what they're doing. Now, some of these guys have put out videos, seen one from a couple from Tunisian fighters who claim that they came to train, and they talk about training and militancy, but they don't offer any specifics, and it's hard to know the veracity of what they're saying. And so there's an assumption that they're training on shooting, on building explosives, but there's no definitive proof of in terms of not only what they're doing, but where they're doing it or for how long.
Mm-hmm. All right, and then, so I guess let me ask you a little bit more about Egypt. Can I? Oh, no, I guess you got to go, right?
Sure.
Oh, you got a minute?
If you'd like, yeah, I'll take you. Of course, I'd be happy to.
Okay, yeah. So I guess I just was hoping you could give us a thumbnail sketch of the power, of what's left of the Muslim Brotherhood. Are all their leaders in jail still? And are they going to be allowed to participate in any coming elections? Are there going to be any coming elections? I heard that they were putting forward a draft constitution, but I don't know if anybody took it seriously or what.
No, those are all great questions. So the Muslim Brotherhood, their leadership is most of it has been arrested, and we're going now at about third or fourth tier in terms of leadership. And it's a big deal for the Muslim Brotherhood because they're such a centralized organization. And so when one eliminates their leadership, it made it very hard for them to organize and mobilize. And on top of that, their political party, the Freedom and Justice Party, has been deemed illegal. And so they appear to be at this point quite marginalized. That said, the military, while they were roundly embraced for going after the Muslim Brotherhood, have now targeted revolutionaries. We've seen a number of revolutionary leaders arrested in the last few weeks, and I think that's starting to create some worry and concern amongst Egyptians about the return of the very state that they were rising against just 2 years ago. We've just learned that there will be a referendum on the Constitution on January 14th. The assumption is that the Constitution will pass, but there will be a sizable minority that oppose it. And that will pose real problems for Egypt because to move forward, it seems difficult to do so when so many people have very real questions and, in fact, object to the draft Constitution that's been put in place. And so while there have been promises for parliamentary and presidential elections after January, there isn't a feeling that this will lead to more stability, but rather that Egypt's entering a period of persistent instability as it still sorts out what kind of state it wants to emerge after Mubarak and how the military will go about governing the state and what role it will have in the future of the state because there's no alternative to the military. And so it really becomes a question of how they conduct themselves rather than what opposing forces come forward. And the sense is if they go too far and bring back Mubarak practices too much, which appears to be happening, that you'll start to see protests and instability once again.
Mm-hmm. All right, and now real quick, if I can ask you, because I forgot, can you say anything about what's going on in Gaza with the flooding?
Well, I can tell you that the region's just not prepared. Even the best, even in Cairo, it's not prepared for the kind of rain and snowfall that we've seen, which is quite rare. And so in a place like Gaza, which is so cramped and so confined, and the infrastructure already is so poor, that it becomes incredibly susceptible to mass flooding, even just with the smallest amounts of rain. And this is an unusual amount of snow and rain for the region. And so it's an area that struggles under the best of circumstances. And so the flooding has really crippled basic daily life in Gaza. And it's something we've seen throughout the region, but it's particularly difficult in a place like Gaza and because of the way it's set up, because of the amount of people that live in that in such a small space. Mm-hmm.
And is there any international help coming or anything like that?
If there is, I'm not aware of it. That doesn't mean it's not happening, but it's one of these things that I'm not sure how quickly international help can arrive. Just the logistics of getting international help to a region like that poses its own challenges. So even if it's coming in place, I'm not sure how much impact it can have because under the best of circumstances, it's hard to get equipment and supplies into Gaza. And now with the, this affects roads and transportation and everything else. And so how much that help can arrive and whether it can arrive in a way that's timely enough for those who need it, I'm not sure. It's possible.
Well, thank you very much for your time. I sure appreciate it.
Oh, it's a pleasure.
All right,
everybody, so much.
That is Nancy Youssef from McClatchy Newspapers, trying to keep warm in the snow there in Cairo, Egypt. McClatchyDC.com. Benghazi, Libya has become training hub for Islamist fighters. And now to the story out of Wichita, and I'm betting that most of you guys were betting correctly that, wait a minute, is this another one of them things? Another one of thems? So some guy drove a truck full of what he thought was a bunch of explosives to the airport to blow him and everybody else up. But then it turned out it was a fake bomb and the FBI set him up. And now here's what's fun about this, because now we're at entrapment case number 53 or whatever. That's Trevor Aronson's numbers, which I would defer to him on for sure. 53 outright entrapment terrorism cases since September 11th here. And they don't even hide it anymore. They don't even know that they're supposed to be ashamed. And I told you this before, and then I just read somebody the other day saying the same thing. Any one of these kooks who goes online and goes, I want to join Al-Qaeda, and it's really the FBI they're talking to, all that would have to happen is you send an FBI agent over there to say, hey, we're watching you, pal. Knock off this whole I want to be a jihadi thing or else. And then that's it. You're done. Case over. Everybody goes about their life. But what does the FBI do? Oh, you want to be in Al-Qaeda, huh? Tell you what, we'll pay you $50,000 to be in Al-Qaeda. We'll let a child molester out of prison if he can only get you to say you want to be Al-Qaeda into an open microphone. You idiot. And they do this over and over and over again. And there have been some huge bogus terrorism cases where they didn't do anything at all. There have been many, many more of those where it's all just a bunch of trumped up nonsense. But there are now at least, this has got to be 52 or 53, outright entrapments where the FBI completely makes up the entire plot from beginning to end, just like the Miami 7, just like Lodi, California, which Lodi, that kid, he didn't even do anything. That thing was such a travesty, it gets its own category. Hamid Hayat. Man, they ought to build a statue of him in every law school in America. This kid that you all failed. The legal profession of America completely. Anyway, it just goes on and on. Terry Lee Lowen went Googling around and found an FBI agent willing to groom him, to exploit him, and make a news story out of him. And that's it. And so somewhere, somebody's mom was overheard to say, "Oh no, did you hear about the terror case from Wichita, Kansas?" But you know what? I think people are catching on to this. That's what I think. Do you think that? Hey, chat room guys, you think people are catching on to this? I kind of think they are. Oh, yeah. It's just another sting operation. Oh, you got me. And by the way, your new best friend who's trying to get you to do something stupid is, well, at least, maybe not, but is quite possibly a cop. And especially if it's something politically stupid, he's definitely a cop. If somebody's trying to get you to do something violent for political reasons, then come on. You're an idiot. You're the mark in this situation. You might think you're playing the long con, but nope. You're the one getting played. So knock it off. Seems like people would have thought of that by now. Anyway, read Trevor Aronson, again at Mother Jones. That's twice I mentioned Mother Jones in the show. Trevor Aronson, The Terror Factory. In fact, I think is that the same title of the really great story that he did for the magazine before he wrote the book? Something like that. Anyway, Trevor Aronson, FBI entrapment cases. These are your Google terms. Amazon.com or your favorite bookseller. What a joke. To me, it's like Phil, a longtime friend of the show, is always comparing every part of American policy, domestic and foreign, to an episode of The Three Stooges. And you know what? I think at this point it's worse, right? I mean, come on. I think it's worse than The Three Stooges. Torture report. We talked about this numerous times. That Dianne Feinstein's staff has written up a 6,000-page torture report. She's the Intelligence Committee chair in the Senate. She's got the authority to tell them, to let them see it and write it up. And they did it, a 6,000-page report. Can you imagine if you could have Marcy Wheeler and the other Scott Horton looking at that thing for, you know, a month or so and then getting back to you about it? So, Marcy, what'd you find in the torture report that you read all of? And then get right to the point. Man, oh man. See, here's my thing about this. And maybe not. But I want to get all pie in the sky for a second. I think that maybe 6,000 pages and 30,000 footnotes. I think if this comes out, that maybe it'll change the history of the world. And that maybe there could be accountability. And maybe some people, I know, not George W. Bush, I'm not ridiculous here, but maybe somebody could be prosecuted for the CIA torture program. You know, give us Cheney and Bush's lawyers, at least. Give us you and Feith and Haynes. Give us Addington. Prosecute them. Prosecute the torture team lawyers. Judge Bybee. Put them in the dock. Do something. Affirm. I won't even call it reaffirm, okay? I won't patronize you. Affirm that actually the one of the principal definitions, foundational cornerstones of Western civilization is that we don't torture. And people who do torture, they go to prison. Simple as that. You're a torturer, we lock you in prison. And, of course, you know, I'd like to see Cheney and Bush buried in the deepest dungeons of all, because they're the ones who put the signatures on it and directed the program and got it done. It was their responsibility. I'm not trying to let them off, but I'm just trying to say, you know what? Prosecute Feith and then see what he starts saying when he squeals, you know? Wouldn't you like to hear Feith squeal a little bit? Well, Dick Cheney said he wanted me to torture Al-Libi into saying that he met Saddam Hussein one time over a chemical weapons party where they trained on how to hijack planes one time. Yeah. All he had to do was pull his fingernails out and beat him with a stick and hang him upside down for a week and freeze him almost to death 15 times in a row. And yeah. Anyway. They got a torture report, 6,000 pages, and you know what? Who else got access to that thing? It's time for someone to take it upon themselves to put this on WikiLeaks.org. Give it to Assange, and Assange will publish it. And then Marcy Wheeler will read it all, and then she'll explain what all's in it that we need to know. And I'm not really saying I believe in the state or that I think the Department of Justice should exist or anything like that, but I'm just saying as long as it does exist, I want to see it prosecute Bush officials for torturing people. And Obama ones too, because, and you know, including the presidents. They're torturers too. Obama's been torturing Somalis. But, anyway. And yeah, McClatchy strikes again is, of course, Lande, Jonathan Lande was the one who showed, I won't say proved, like with mathematical scientific certainty, but it was Lande that showed that Dick Cheney ordered the torture right before and right after the launch of the war in Iraq, especially, in order to get these captured friends of Osama to say that they'd worked with Saddam. I need lies. Beat it out of them. That was the key. That was the core of the torture in the Bush regime. Anyway, we'll be right back after this. It's the Scott Horton Show. Hey, you own a business? Maybe we should consider advertising on the show. See if we can make a little bit of money. My email address is scott@scotthorton.org. Hey, all, Scott Horton here for thebumpersticker.com. I created it but quickly sold to Rick so I could do this instead. In the decades since, he's made one hell of a great company. Thebumpersticker.com makes digitally printed, photo-quality, full-color bumper stickers for your band or your business, as well as magnets, adhesive vinyl decals, and labels for products and industrial use, and your political cause or campaign, too. Thebumpersticker.com also offers full custom graphic design for bringing your idea to reality. Let thebumpersticker.com help you get the word out. That's thebumpersticker.com at thebumpersticker.com. And tell them you heard it here. Hey y'all, Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson is a successful former hedge fund manager whose site is unique on the web. Subscribers are allowed a window into Mike's very real main account and receive announcements and explanations for all his market moves. The Federal Reserve has been inflating the money supply to finance the bank bailouts and terror war overseas.
So Mike's betting on commodities, mining stocks, European markets, and other hedges against our depreciating dollar. Play along on paper or with real money, and then be your own judge of Mike's investment strategies. See what happens at WallStreetWindow.com.
All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. ScottHorton.org and Facebook, Scott Horton Show, and all that. All right. Next up on the show today is Philip Giraldi, former CIA and DIA officer. Now he's a writer for the American Conservative Magazine and Antiwar.com and UNS.com. And he also is executive director of the Council for the National Interest. Welcome back to the show, Phil. How you doing?
I'm fine, Scott. How about you?
I'm doing good. Appreciate you joining us today. Hey, do you have a title of some kind at UNS.com? You want to talk about that for a minute?
Yeah, well, this is a new website that's founded by Ron Unz, who was the publisher at the American Conservative and has been a longtime supporter of the antiwar.com. And basically, we conceive it as a website for alternative views. And what we mean by that is we're not locked into any kind of ideological position. If you can make a good argument, make the good argument, we'll print it. We don't want to be cast as libertarian. We don't want to be cast as traditional conservative or as progressive. We just want to have stuff appearing that will be of interest, and we'll be making compelling arguments for alternative viewpoints. I'm the editor of the National Security and Foreign Policy section, so that's my connection with it.
Great. And that's UNZ.com, UNZ.com, an alternative media selection. And, of course, antiwar.com has been running a lot of good ones from there lately. And like you say, from all different perspectives, but only top quality stuff. So I've been enjoying reading it lately. And we're going to talk about your piece, which is really something else here. Why remain in Afghanistan? Some of the best stuff about Afghanistan I've read in a while, actually. We'll put that off for a minute because I wanted to ask you about Robert Levinson. This is the big story about the former FBI agent missing in Iran. It was Ahmadinejad holding this guy hostage, apparently. Everybody said on TV anyway, until the AP and then the New York Times came out and said, well, he was working for the CIA. There's a whole mystery about a separate rogue faction of analysts were running this guy instead of the covert action division and all of this and that. So what's the story? Set us straight, Phil.
Well, the story is that nobody who's writing about this really understands how this stuff works at CIA. And after 9/11, the CIA hired something like 10,000 contractors. And essentially this guy, Levinson, was the product of that. He was picked up by the CIA as a contractor. He had been an FBI investigator working on Russian organized crime, which is, of course, also Israeli organized crime, which is also organized crime and drug trafficking for much of the middle part of the world. And so anyway, he was an expert. So he was picked up by the division of the Proliferation Division, which has a branch that deals with money transfers relating to drug trafficking and other things. This is quite normal. And the guy would have been picked up, given his background, as an investigator. Now, does this make the guy a CIA agent or anything like that? No, he's a contractor. He's picked up. He has particular expertise in terms of criminal activity of a certain type. And I'm sure this committee or this group in CIA, which was consisted of analysts, was essentially using him in a perfectly legitimate fashion to go to places like Latin America, check out public records, bank account information, that kind of stuff. So he wasn't a spy, okay? Now, what happened at some point, the woman who was running this decided that she was going to use him for other things that were forbidden, that basically were spying type activities, and she was going to cover it by just not telling her bosses about it. And, of course, you know, you figure out how a big bureaucracy works. That's easy enough to do. And so I think a lot of these other kind of, you know, innuendos and stories that are being fed into this are basically a failure to comprehend that, yeah, this guy was a CIA contractor, but that doesn't mean that CIA sent him on this mission. This woman with whom he had a personal and kind of a business relationship was the one who did it. And I think people are looking for something deeper than that. They're not going to find it.
Well, why not? I mean, hey, it's...
Because it ain't there. All right, and I would suspect, I mean, if you read the whole story on this guy, which I'm sure you have, he was involved with, you know, organized Russian crime. Organized Russian crime is organized Israeli crime. It has a lot of other things that are pulled in with it. These are very bad people. These are people who are killers, who are drug traffickers, who are, you know, responsible for all kinds of crimes. So anyway, these are the people that he got involved with. And I would suspect when the Iranians are telling us that we don't know where he is, I would believe that they don't know where he is. And I would suspect if he's still alive, he's somewhere else. He's in Pakistan, or he's, you know, he could even be in Israel. He could be anywhere. And I think there's a, you know, a lot of confusion. They're looking for a conspiracy theory inside CIA to explain this, but it just ain't there as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah. And now, as far as what all he was up to, you're going on Occam's razor here, or you're going about, you know, based on what you really know because of what people in the CIA are still telling you, or what?
Well, people aren't telling me anything about this. I mean, I read the after-action report. I read the critique that the agency made about the activity, and it rings true to me that this is, you know, I worked as a contractor back in 2001, 2002 for the agency. I won't tell you what exactly I was doing or anything like that, but I was making a lot of trips. I was not spying. I was going to various places, and I was doing things quite openly, accessing public records and doing various things. Mm. And there's no reason to assume that this guy wasn't doing something similar. Yeah. Until the woman he was involved with decided that she was going to have him do stuff that she knew would not stand scrutiny. Mm. So I you know, it all just fits to me, and I'm not seeing a whole lot of stuff from my fellow ex-spies in the usual circles that we discuss these things to give any contradictory argument on this. I think that's the way it is.
Yeah. All right. So now I want to talk about Afghanistan, because I think this is a lot more important than that old story. I never did pay much mind to it anyway, because it's just some guy.
Well, the problem is it's being exploited by guys like McCain, see, because they're trying to nail the Iranians on this, and to imply that the Iranians have taken this guy and have tortured him and held him. So there is an important sub-story here.
Right.
And that's what's disturbing, that it's being politicized and it's being played like a political game in terms of, you know, let's get the administration and let's get the CIA and let's basically derail negotiations with Iran. And, you know, that's what's happening.
Yeah. Now, Kerry, I think he seems to be operating under the same assumption that you're saying, though, that he doesn't probably, he's acting like he doesn't think Iran really does have him, or he's not accusing them of having him, right?
Yeah, I suspect that they don't have him, because this is small potatoes. If they had him, they would probably let him go. I mean, they're serious about cutting a deal with the West on their nuclear program. I think they would let him go. I suspect they don't have him.
Yeah, that was my impression too. That if they did, Ahmadinejad would have said, "Ha ha, we caught your CIA agent," or something like that back then. You know?
Absolutely. Sure, they could have ground that into the propaganda mill, and they would have had a pretty good story about this CIA spy sent in into Iran, and they didn't do it.
Yeah, all right. So yeah, that is an important point, though, that it's one more talking point for those trying to ruin the nuclear deal. And I guess you must have seen that the Iranians refused to let Obama's imposition of new sanctions ruin everything, and they've agreed to keep talking. How much more of this abuse do you think they can take and still get all the way to the deal 6 months from now, 5 months now?
Well, my sources are telling me that they're dead serious about this, that they really want a deal. So I think the Iranians are willing to bend. Now, the question is Obama going to do something that he knows will deliberately derail it because he's under pressure from his own party? I don't know. Yeah. I don't know the answer to that one, but I think the Iranians will do everything possible to make this work.
Well, you know, everybody keeps saying that the Senate's going to pass the sanctions in January, but even if they do, Obama can veto them, right, or not? It's not like they can override his veto. They don't have that many votes.
Well, he could veto it, and of course, then the question is, does he have enough votes to not have them override the veto? Well, who knows? Israel very often gets, you know, 99 senators lined up behind it.
Right. Yeah, you see that napkin? I can get 77 senators' signatures on that by morning. Remember that? That was the head of APAC.
That's right. Yeah, Rosen. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah. Rosen, he was more than just the head of APEC. Anyway.
Yeah, well, he was their bag man.
Okay, so now, why remain in Afghanistan? Phil, who's going to remain in Afghanistan? What's the deal? I thought Obama said by the end of next year it'll all be over finally.
Well, what I did was in the article I went through the what I thought were the possible reasons why it made sense, or why the government is trying to make sense of staying. And I couldn't come up with a good reason. I mean, I basically said, look, it's like an Iraq situation where you have this big embassy and you have this big CIA presence and everything like that, and you want to have the military around just to protect them. Well, okay, but CIA is pretty well able to protect itself, and the embassy is just going to hire 6,000 guards. So that argument doesn't make sense. And then, but you go a little bit deeper and you start thinking about it. And you say, well, really, it's to avoid an Iraq situation where everything kind of breaks down without an American presence. But that's a bad argument too, because nobody in their right mind would think that that's anything but a Band-Aid, and that it's just a temporary expedient. And basically, whatever is going to happen in Afghanistan is going to happen. And if we put it off by 5 more years, we're just going to kill a lot more people in the process and just spend a lot more money. So that doesn't make any sense either. And then the final argument I came up with was just that the U.S. government is so embarrassed by the horrible things that it's been doing for the last few years that it's trying to save face and pretend that this is actually a viable option to keep the thing going. And so I figured, well, I'll just throw that out for what it's worth.
Yeah. Well, now, I guess their argument of trying to prop up Karzai makes more sense than, oh, we're going to try to find the last 10 Arabs in Waziristan and kill them with drones or whatever. But how bad of a catastrophe would it be if the Taliban took over Kabul? And would it be another 1990s, you know, 5-6 year civil war? All that kind of madness all over again, and totalitarian Taliban rule eventually under Mullah Omar or whoever's next?
Well, yeah, who knows? I mean, the fact is we don't know. But the obviously what even Karzai is pushing for right now is negotiations with the Taliban, because, you know, he knows he doesn't control most of the country. He controls very little of it. And there are a lot of warlords who control other bits of it. So there has to be some kind of, you know, integrated solution to what's going on there. And basically a continued U.S. military presence doesn't necessarily guarantee anything. I think that's part of the problem. And you know, one of the interesting things was when I wrote the piece, and I'm sure you read some of the comments on it, this argument about the pipeline, you know, the pipeline that's going to be constructed across Afghanistan and everything, I mean, that project hasn't been viable for years, and yet it keeps popping up because people want to find a reason rooted in capitalism or in classic imperialism to explain why we're there. I just don't think that argument holds at all. That we're there for a lot of stupid reasons, like we got in for, you know, probably for a good reason in the beginning, and then never could quite figure out what we were doing after that. I mean, we've done that everywhere else.
Yeah, well, it's just like LBJ said, I don't want to be the first president to lose a war, so make it happen on Nixon's watch. I'm out of here. Bye. This is somebody else's problem, not mine. That's what Bush said about Iraq,
too.
That's exactly
the thinking. Yeah, that's exactly the thinking. I think, you know, the United States is like a wounded beast. I mean, it's just, it doesn't make, our policies just don't make sense anymore. And as much as you want to listen, it's pretty hard to listen to Kerry, but I mean, you got to listen to him and see if he's actually saying something. And, you know, his comment about the Palestinians the other day, where he said that the Israeli Arabs were a time bomb in the heart of Israel. I mean, he's basically giving them, you know, a green light to ethnically cleanse them. I mean, how stupid are these people? Are they? Don't they realize that what they're saying? I don't really know.
Yeah, and that's probably not what he meant at all either, but he really is just that bad at talking, you know, which I can sympathize with because I'm pretty bad at talking sometimes, but boy, that John Kerry, he's another Joe Biden, you know, where, whoops, I didn't kind of mean that.
Biden and Kerry, they're probably separated at birth.
Yeah, I mean, what Kerry's really saying, he's trying to beat the Israelis over the head and say, you know, come to an equitable solution here so that this isn't a continuing problem. But then, as you point out, he accidentally completely dehumanizes a million people and justifies their, you know, massive relocation. Oops.
Yeah, it's just it seems like, you know, I wrote a piece, I don't remember where it was, I guess it was on the Young's place, and I basically said the problem with U.S. foreign policy is that it's linear. They treat every problem like it's a separate problem, and they try to figure out some way to fix it, and they don't realize that all these problems are interconnected. And that's why our policy is so bad. And it's, you know, the previous imperial powers like Britain and France and the Roman Empire, they kind of figured out these things a lot better than we do.
Yeah. You know, a friend sent me a link to the Houston housewife who she's the lobbyist lady who worked with the congressman on funding the Mujahideen in the 80s. And,
yeah.
I'm sorry, Charlie Wilson's War and all that, right? The lady
right,
with the hair.
Right.
Julia Roberts in the movie. And
right.
And he, the reporter, I guess it's the Houston Chronicle, reporter asked her, well, what about the idea that what you did back then is what led to September 11th? And she just says, oh, dear, you know, if we knew what the consequences of what we did was going to cause the next wars, then we wouldn't have them. So...
Too late for that.
So, you know, we must persist in folly because we're doing great at folly.
Yeah. So anyway, my conclusion of the article was basically there are no good reasons to stay in Afghanistan when you weigh the downside, and the downside is, you know, what it's going to cost us, and you have a completely corrupt government there that's not going to be fixed. You know, an American presence is not going to make us any safer necessarily, and so it's one of those things. Where's the argument, or where's the beef, Mr. Obama? I don't get it. But I suspect it's, you know. But I guess I really didn't explore this in the article. But you know, it's domestic politics again. Obama doesn't want to look like a loser before the 2014 congressional elections, and he probably wants to, you know, also be able to fudge this issue into 2016 before, you know, for the next presidential election. Mm-hmm. It's, you know, I bet a lot of that is what drives this.
Yeah, hey, that's what happened with the whole surge back in 2009 in the first place was the, you know, the political hacks in the White House said you can't end two wars or the Republicans will call you a wimp and you'll be a one-term president. So he decided to make the bet on more power for him and more dead bodies for everybody else.
Yeah, that's I think probably the most compelling reason for why we want to stay in Afghanistan. I mean, otherwise, it just doesn't make any sense at all. I mean, it's, yeah, sure. I mean, if we pull out, they're going to be people killed, but if we stay, they're going to be people killed. I mean, it's a Faustian bargain if you think that this thing is going to work.
Mm. Yeah, in fact, you know, the Washington Post, you might remember, reported it was an excerpt from the book Little America about the war in Afghanistan, and part of it was about how there was a CIA report in the fall of 2009. Everybody might remember that Sarah Palin and other Republicans were accusing Obama of dithering, and even the generals were coming out saying it's taken too long to decide on the surge and all of that. And the CIA report said, don't bother surging because it's not going to work. All it's going to do is prolong everything and talk just like what you just said. And
yeah.
And that Obama knew he had already been told what was in the report, and so he refused to read it. He didn't want to be on the record of having read the report. He refused to look at the report. He already knew what it said, don't do it. And then he did it anyway and escalated another 60,000 troops.
Well, that explains, you know, why we're in the mess we're in, because we have leaders that basically are not interested in leading and not interested in doing what's good for the country. They're just interested in doing what's good for their faction. And, of course, that's what George Washington and the others all warned about.
Yeah. And did you see the thing in the Washington Times about where the Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for Afghanistan and his counterpart at the State Department and one of the other guys in uniform, I believe, none of the three of them could name, even estimate, the number of dead Americans from the last year of war or the cost from the last year of war over there?
Wow.
They were stumped. It was Dana Rohrabacher asked them about it, and it was literally, the scene was them sitting at the tables there looking at each other saying, does anybody know? Does anybody know? No, I'm sorry, Congressman, none of us. No, they didn't even have a ballpark estimate, Phil, for how many Americans had died in the war in the last year. Can you believe that?
Well, it's because for them, war is an abstraction. There's funny stuff going on in Ukraine right now, which I'm sure you're following closely. And so, you know, it's a replay of the funny stuff that went on in Georgia and the funny stuff that goes on in Belarus and goes on everywhere else. It just seems like there's no learning curve. Victoria Nuland was in Kiev the other day passing out candy to the kids, and the kids didn't want to take the candy. They were more serious than she was.
Oh, that's funny. I didn't see that. Dan McAdams is coming on to talk about that in a few minutes from the Ron Paul Institute.
Yeah, ask him about that, because it was apparently Victoria Nuland was this is our diplomacy, and Victoria Nuland is, she's now the Assistant Secretary of State for Europe and Central Europe. I'm not sure what it is, but it's frightening how these people, she's married to Kagan. These people never disappear. They Democrat, Republican, it doesn't make any difference. Yeah. They're always with us.
Yeah, especially the Kagans. Those guys, they'll attach right to you.
And their spouses, too. I mean, it's just, you know, it's like if the government is inclined towards hiring a woman for the sake of hiring a woman, they've got a woman.
Right, yeah. It's always either their wife or their sister or something. As Jim Loeb said, hey, it's all in the neocon family. This Thanksgiving, all of the worst neoconservatives in the world are sitting down and having turkey dinner together.
That's right.
They're all married to each other's mom. All right. And now you did a review for antiwar.com of Congress Scares the People. And you compared the hysterical cries of Dianne Feinstein and Mike Rogers about all the terrible terrorist dangers that are facing us that justify their unlimited power over our lives. And you were comparing that with the government's official estimate of how many terrorists there actually are in the world and how much danger that actually amounts to. Could you please give us a brief rundown of that?
Yeah, the U.S. government through the State Department every year issues a global terrorism report, and the numbers have been going down every year. Now, the numbers have shot up this year purely because of one place, and that's Iraq. And there have been lots of killings in Iraq, sectarian killings, no question about it. And they count all these killings as terrorism. And, of course, it's 100% Muslims that are being killed by other Muslims. But yet they've conflated this into a terrorist threat. There are more terrorists. The terrorists are all over the place. And the terrorists are out to kill us and so on and so forth. As I pointed out in the piece, there are very few terrorists anyway that... There even fewer of these terrorists are either disposed to or have the capabilities or the training or the language ability or the money to attack the United States. And so all this stuff is kind of, it's alarmist. It's taking a threat that doesn't kill anyone. There were three terrorist killings in the United States in the last 2 years, and they were at the Boston Marathon. So that's 1.5 killings per year statistically, and the U.S. government and local governments and state governments are spending something like $1 trillion to counter this threat. So there's something out of sync here, and of course people like Feinstein and Rogers are people whose reputations are based on the fact that they've been part of this program, part of this agenda, and so they don't want to face up to the fact that this is all a fraud.
Well, first of all, the fact that they would use the continuing civil war left over from our late war in that country, in Iraq, over there, and just use that to build up the numbers for PR's sake, that's pretty disgusting if you ask me. Those are real people whose lives are being literally blown apart to this day because of that madness.
Yeah, it's pretty scary. I mean, these are basically smart people. They have access to the best information, and just because their mind is set a certain way, they're never going to see anything but what they want to see. And that's been the horrible thing of the last 12, 13 years. Mm. I had a
Do they count the Syrian jihadists in this? Do their suicide bombings count as terrorism or not?
Yeah, they're counting those too, and of course those are terrorists that we supported, because we wanted to throw out the terrible Assad. So,
I'm sorry, but I interrupted you there with that.
Yeah, no, I was just saying I had lunch with some former CIA colleagues last week, and it was kind of shocking. And we were talking a bit about I always try to low key my actual views because I know that most of them won't quite go along with the extent that I see it. But we're talking about this. We're talking about the terrorism and stuff like that. And these are people who've served overseas. They speak foreign languages. They know foreign cultures and stuff like that. And yet the wife turned to me and she said, "Well, but at least we're the good guys." And I almost freaked out at that point, and I said, how can we be the good guys when we have a president who kills U.S. citizens without any due process? When we kill wedding parties, that was the day when the wedding party was wiped out in Yemen. And I said, and we wipe out whole wedding parties, and we never have to say we're sorry. I said, how are we the good guys? And they didn't even answer. They just kind of looked away, he's talking crazy again.
Yeah.
Depressing. Yeah.
I can completely identify with that because I remember being a child. And I remember when I was a child, there was us and them. And their lives don't count because that's what I was taught. If you dress up in green and you kill, like against the Nazis in World War II or whatever it is, that's the great big exception to thou shalt not kill. Government employment. So whatever, man. Foreigners don't really count. They're like, it's like the 3/8 compromise or whatever the hell, or something like that. It's fine to kill. I remember even when I was 14, it was the first Iraq war, nuke Iraq till they glow. And I remember thinking that was fine because I just thought a nuclear explosion would look cool. I didn't care how many people died in it, but I was 14 and I kind of got over it. But apparently that's just the way, that's what it means to be an American, is to see it that way,
Yeah, I'm afraid it is, actually. It's so depressing because, it's just, okay, let's at least sit down and figure out that the last 12 years really haven't worked. I mean, they've killed a lot of people, they've cost a lot of money, and we're no more secure or anything now. Or if we are more secure, it really has nothing to do with the policies. And, let's kind of figure that out. But they won't even figure that out. It's like there's a one of the other CIA people at this lunch said, well, we have to use drones because we have to get at those terrorists hiding up in the mountains in Pakistan. And I said, well, that would be fine if you knew that the guy you're zapping was a terrorist. But if you're doing a signature strike and you're catching some young guy who's going to see his girlfriend or something, what's the point there? And, again, they sort of shrug and it's like, don't tell me these things. They may not be true and I don't really care. Yep. So, anyway.
Yep, it's nationalism. It's poison. We're out of time, but thanks. It's a good interview. Thanks, Phil.
Okay, Scott. Okay, bye-bye.
Appreciate it. That's Phil Giraldi, everybody. He's executive director at the Council for the National Interest, former CIA and DIA officer. UNZ.com, U-N-Z, UNZ.com, as well as antiwar.com and the American Conservative Magazine. And Dan McAdams coming up in just a sec. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to talk to you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State, The Cold War Origins of the Military-Industrial Complex and the Power Elite. In the book, Swanson explains what the revolution was, the rise of empire, and the permanent military economy, and all from a free market libertarian perspective. Jacob Hornberger, founder and president of the Future Freedom Foundation, says the book is absolutely awesome.
and that Swanson's perspectives on the Cold War and the Cuban Missile Crisis are among the best I've read. The poll numbers state that people agree on one thing. It's that America is on the wrong track. In the war state, Swanson gets to the bottom of what's ailing our society. Empire. The permanent national security bureaucracy that runs it, and the mountain of debt that has enabled our descent down this dark road. The War State could well be the book that finally brings this reality to the level of mainstream consensus. America can be saved from its government and its arms dealers. First, get the facts. Get The War State by Michael Swanson, available at your local bookseller and at Amazon.com. Or just click on the book in the right margin at scotthorton.org.
Hey, y'all, Scott here, hawking stickers for the back of your truck. They've got some great ones at libertystickers.com. Get your son killed, Jeb Bush, 2016. FDR, no longer the worst president in American history. The National Security Agency, blackmailing your congressman since 1952. And USA, sometimes we back Al-Qaeda, sometimes we don't. And there's over 1,000 other great ones on the wars, police state, elections, the Federal Reserve, and more at libertystickers.com. They'll take care of all your custom printing for your band or your business at thebumpersticker.com. Libertystickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck.
All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. Next up is Dan McAdams from the Ron Paul Institute. Boy, I should have his tab open. Here it is, ronpaulinstitute.org. Welcome back to the show. How are you doing?
Thanks, Scott. Great to talk to you again.
Good to have you here. Man, you've been writing a lot of good stuff lately. Some of it's at RT. That's the Ukraine piece. We're going to get to that in a minute. But first of all, you had a guest article by a guy whose name was hard to memorize, but it was a brilliant rundown of who's who and who's doing what in the jihadist war in Syria against Shiite and Christian civilians in the Jabhat al-Nusra and et cetera like that. And then you've got one here that I hope everyone will go read. Again, ronpaulinstitute.org. Is the U.S. waking up to the insanity of its Syria policy? And I can say I only hope, but I wonder what you could possibly be referring to that would give you hope that such a thing could be true.
Yeah, well, my hope was it lasted about 5 minutes while I, you know, finished writing this piece, and then it started to damper again because we heard some whispers that the U.S. might be starting talks with this Islamic Front, which is created and financed by our wonderful friends, the Saudis, who always seem to be financing extremism everywhere, basically as a fig leaf over the Al-Qaeda who's running things in Syria, you know. So that's already tarnished, so they created this Islamic Front, which is like a supergroup. You remember Asia in the 80s? It's like a supergroup that's going to make us not think about Al-Qaeda too much. The problem is the Islamic Front and Al-Qaeda have been cooperating for quite some time in Syria, so it's a move by the U.S. They realize the reality on the ground is that their so-called moderates do not exist. What little there was in the first place has disintegrated, and they're left with, you know, a couple of Ahmad Chalabi types. So they're trying to figure out what to do, and so they're, you know, apparently getting ready to hold talks with this group, which would really do nothing but prolong the war, prolong the agony, prolong the killing. So, you know, we can be slightly optimistic, and what the piece was about was that the former CIA director, Michael Hayden, said, you know, of all the bad scenarios in Syria, probably the least bad would be, you know, at this point if Assad stays in power, because the alternatives look even worse. So, you know, it's the U.S. has put itself in a tight spot with its interventionism, you know, now it doesn't know what to do.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, and I guess the previous policy was, at first they thought he was going to go, but then they must have realized back in, by late 2011, well, we're talking about the Democrats, so at least by halfway through 2012 or at some point they had to have accepted that, okay, Assad is not falling, it's not as easy as we thought it was going to be, and so then plan B was, well, just make them, you know, fight each other, scorpions in a bottle kind of a thing, and weaken everybody all around. But now, I guess they're worried that the jihadists are going to win, or only half the government is. Retired Bush officials are concerned, but the Democrats want to persist. Is that it?
Yeah, well, I think they're hoping that, that the different jihadist groups might fight it out, and that some of the, I don't know if they're hoping this, but that some of the, what moderates there are, some of them have gone back to the government because they realize that the people they have been fighting with are much worse than Assad in terms of brutality and that sort of thing.
Yeah, I'd read that.
But, you know, the U.S., unfortunately, it falls victim to its own myths and its own stories. You know, it believes the lies and the propaganda that it tells us. And so it came to believe that there was this massive uprising in Syria of people who wanted democracy and all these wonderful things, and that would be enough to change the regime. But the fact of the matter is, if the entire country was as unhappy as they were saying, there's no way the president could have lasted this long. So, you know, it was largely fomented from without. It was fomented by Saudi Arabia and Qatar, the Gulf states, you know, who are fighting sort of a proxy war with Iran in Syria. You know, so it's it was much more complex, but they wanted to portray it as the, you know, as a little guy standing up against the dictator. And that's not to say that we want to go over there and give Assad a hug. That's irrelevant to us because at least, you know, you and I, what we care about is interventionism and the U.S. role in it. We don't care who rules anywhere as long as they don't bother us, right?
Well, sure. I mean, I care, but that doesn't mean I'm trying to give a permission slip to my government to do anything about or do something horrible in the name of what I care about. You know,
because
I condemn
they
any tyranny
up.
In
they
the world.
They mess up everything they touch here, and they mess up everything they touch overseas.
Yeah.
You don't get it right.
But no, I mean, I agree with you that in this day and age, opinion means something you want the national government to do to somebody. So people just make that leap immediately, and I certainly am not in favor of that. But, you know, all things being equal, nobody's got the right to inherit a dictatorship from anybody who never had the right to one in the first place ever. So, you know, that's pretty much that.
Yeah, but, you know, we don't like to tell our neighbors how they should live. And, you know, I mean, it's we may like our system the way we have it, but other people do have different views of the way they want to live. The Iranians seem to want to live in a country with that, you know, religious rule tends to be very strong, much stronger than here. It wouldn't be my cup of tea, to be honest, but who am I to say? I don't know.
Yeah, no, I mean, and there are certainly societies where the hugest of supermajorities would agree that they want religious law, and that would be up to them and not me. But so in this case, to get back to the specifics here, I was wondering if you could help break down, because there, I don't even know what difference there ever really was between the Al-Nusra Front and the Islamic State of Iraq, except maybe the Islamic State guys were more Iraqis and the Nusra guys were more local Syrians, but they've been working together this whole time. And so I'm just hoping you can help me understand which factions the Syrians, basically, they're trying to separate the Syrians away and back the Syrians and separate them away from the Iraqis more? Is that what's going on here?
Yeah, I don't know. You know, I often think of the life of Brian when I try to pick these groups out. You know, it's like the People's Front of Judea.
Yeah,
and
exactly.
The Judean People's Front, you know.
So. Which group of suicide bombers is a lie? Is, you know, who? I don't
know. Yeah, but, you know, I mean, I tend to focus more on U.S. policy. Obviously, we have to understand as much as we can about what's going on the ground. But at the same time, we can't understand everything because we're not there. And unlike people like John McCain and the others who pretend they know everything about everything everywhere, we have a pretty good handle on what our policy should be. And I think that's the most important part, you know.
Yeah.
And so that's what I tend to focus on more.
Well, yeah, I mean, although It's a very important argument to make, though, when, for example, John McCain is saying, oh, well, you know, everything's just hunky-dory with the Northern Storm Brigade and the Free Syrian Army when, as you're reporting here, yeah, there is no Free Syrian Army. And even the Northern Storm Brigade were a bunch of veterans of the Iraq War where they'd practiced on killing our guys over there in the last war, Mr. McCain, kind of thing. So the facts on the ground count there, especially, you know, when now we're talking about this new Islamic front, which even if they're trying to say It's somehow separate from the worst of the sworn Al-Qaedaists. It's no different whatsoever. You know what
yeah.
I mean?
I mean,
and in fact, I think, Dan, that because of you and others, I think this view is making progress. And like you're saying, even people like Hayden are sort of coming to their senses. And I think that some of the propaganda about this is falling flat on TV news and stuff, too, where, you know, as even Hillary Clinton said, I mean, who are we supposed to be backing there? It's kind of hard to pick out the good guys.
What I think is kind of funny, Scott, is that this Islamic Front broke into some warehouses and stole a bunch of military equipment that the U.S. had meant for the so-called moderates, you know, and the U.S., you know, sent them a memo saying, could you guys please return this? You're not supposed to get it. You know, we kind of promised the Americans who paid for this that it wouldn't fall into the hands of extremists, you know.
I heard that. I thought it was a prank. Did they really? Yeah, and then they did. They confirmed it. Yes, we did send them a pretty pleased note, which they rejected.
Probably a tweet or something.
Yeah. All right. Well, I was going to say one more thing. There was Patrick Coburn. You referred to the fact that, you know, we're not there. Well, Patrick Coburn's been there a lot of times, and he had this long-form piece in The Independent the other day, Britain's policy on Syria is falling apart, where it's, you know, virtually he's saying the exact same thing as you hear about the hopelessness of what they've gotten us into, the rock and the hard place and all of that, and how nobody knows what's going to come next. But it seems to me like it would be a surprise if there really was a Syria anymore after this, or if it had anything like its old shape anyway.
I mean, it's not to say that just by virtue of traveling and getting around, you're automatically right. But I find that people who do go to these places, they do have a better sense, you know. And I know you know Eric Margolies, who I have enormous respect for, and he's always traveling. He sees the world, and he, you know. So I respect his opinions more because it's very difficult to understand these places and the culture. Things are driven by culture and history, and so it's just difficult to get a real handle on it when you're not there.
Right. Yeah, and both of those guys have been saying for a long time that something huge would have to change in terms of foreign intervention to make Assad lose now. I mean, he's been, winning in the rebellion, so-called rebellion on the run for, you know, what, a year and a half in a row now.
Yeah.
The momentum hasn't been the other way this whole time.
Yeah. What I think is funny, and I kind of mentioned it in the piece I wrote, is that, you know, this sort of leftish humanitarian interventionists, they love to champion the rights of the minorities. And I think, you know, particularly in the U.S., and there's nothing wrong with that, of course, but, you know, the people they've been supporting in Syria, they have a long track record of just wiping out minorities, the Christians, the Alawites, you know, all of these minority groups. They're talk about extreme prejudice, you know, and it just shows the situational ethics of a lot of interventionists.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and by the way, that article I was referring to earlier, it's Dimitri Minin at RonPaulInstitute.org, Sinister Fruits of the West's Alliance with Jihad Warriors in Syria. And that's some good writing there, some serious journalism.
Yeah, he's very good.
Yeah. And it's all bad news, too, I'm afraid to say. These guys are bad news. And you know, this is just, I mean, imagine that it's the 1980s Afghan war or even the Iraq war, only now this much closer to the West, you know, one more country giving them direct access to the Mediterranean Sea. And, you know, who knows from there.
And when you think about all these foreign fighters, you know, I'm not super hyped up on the war on terror because a lot of it's phony, but I am concerned about some of these Western fighters who go over there and they become not only radicalized, but they do learn a lot of techniques that can be quite dangerous. And what's going to happen when they come home? They come back to the UK, they come back to the US, and there are quite a few of them. We should be pretty worried about that, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. This is something Patrick Coburn was saying on the show, too, was that, you know, right now these guys are really focused on killing Shia, but, you know, if they're stopped from being able to continue doing that, they might just turn west. You know, when this thing is over, we're going to have a lot of leftover guys. The next stage of blowback from our interventionism is teeing up now.
Yeah. And
it's
all
that easy to see.
Sure, and all financed by our great friends the Saudis.
And all because we invaded Iraq in the last decade.
Yeah. No, that's the nature of interventionism. It creates new problems that the interventionists want to do more interventions to solve. You know, it's a never-ending cycle.
Well, and speaking of which, let's talk about NATO expansion. You've been really good on these color-coded revolutions, especially concerning these countries in Eastern Europe bordering Russia. And I don't know how anybody could consider Georgia part of the North Atlantic to join the North Atlantic Treaty Organization. But obviously, you know, NATO expansion is a big part of this. But in specific, there was a political fight in Ukraine over a trade deal with the EU or a trade deal with the Russians. And at the last minute, the head politician changed his mind and all hell broke loose. Why don't you get more specific, please?
What's interesting is, you know, the EU's policy all along has been to view this as a sort of a geopolitical, geostrategic move to, you know, sort of bring Ukraine into the fold, i.e. make it part of the EU. And not to say the Russians are saints, but their approach has been to Ukraine that, you know, you can talk to both us and them. We don't have to make a mutually exclusive deal. But Brussels is pulling you into one, and you should think twice about taking it because we buy a lot of your stuff, and they're not going to buy any of your stuff. You know, so certainly it's reasonable to consider the reasons that Yanukovych, the Ukrainian president, at the last minute had some second thoughts. He hasn't shut the door, although the protesters portrayed it as him slamming the door shut. He said, this particular deal I'm a little bit concerned about. I don't really see that it's to our advantage, so I want to hold off and, you know, I don't know, get a better deal or something. But that's when, you're right, I mean, all heck broke loose. People jumped into the streets, and they've been there for a couple of weeks. And, you know, their intent is to overthrow the government. They've used violence. They've occupied government buildings. And, you know, I'm not super keen on police violence, but guess what? You know, what would happen if you and I started to occupy the White House? You know, it wouldn't turn out well for us, Scott.
Well, and I don't know about all the internal politics there. And well, let me ask you this. When you say that they've used violence, what have they done that's violent other than just resist the cops in the street or what?
Well, one of the things that probably wouldn't go over that well here is they took a tractor and they drove it into the police lines, you know, so... And they've used there's videos of them using long chains to beat the police with, you know, sort of 5 or 6 feet lengths of chains against the cops. And you know, so the idea that they're completely peaceful protesters is not the case. And but regardless, you know, obviously people, you know, we believe people should have the right to protest. We have some pretty severe restrictions here in Washington, D.C. as to how you can hold a protest, what you can do, where you can do it. So it's kind of silly for us to expect everywhere else would not have anything similar to what we've had. Yeah, what we see in Kiev is certainly a lot more leeway being given to these protesters than you'd get here in Washington, that's for sure.
Yeah. Well, I'd hate to see modern America be the standard for such things, but I do understand your point.
Well, yeah, look down in Venice, you know, the
cops
are beating up a bunch of...
This is what happens in a democracy. 51% gets their way, or at least, you know, after a public choice theory vote is held, then the people who end up on top of that get to decide. And then if, 49% or 51% are mad, then they can either go along with the decision that they disagree with, or they can try to hold a general strike or what, you know, they don't necessarily have to go along, but that's part of having that kind of a divided society. It is really divided, isn't it? East and West and Orthodox versus Catholic and more Russia-leaning culturally versus more European-leaning. So it's sort of Republicans, Democrats, only I would say with seemingly more substantial differences between the major factions there.
Sure, yeah. But, you know, what really gets me is the hypocrisy on the part of the U.S. and the European Union, particularly the U.S. You know, there have been some violence, there's some violent police reactions, some people have been hurt. But the U.S. is, I mean, literally sending U.S. officials to the protesters to express U.S. support for an overthrow of the government. But look at Venice today. The cops are beating up a bunch of Italians who are protesting against austerity measures that the IMF demands. Look what happened in Romania when they're protesting against the fracking and other things. The cops are beating the heck out of them. Mm-hmm. Look what happened in Egypt. 1,000 people got wiped out who were simply trying to go out and protest in favor of a government that actually had been elected. And the U.S. says nothing about any of these, you know.
Yeah, it didn't bat an eye over that.
Yeah, the hypocrisy is just so repulsive. And then you get these horrible people like John McCain, you know, going into the middle of Kiev, thinking that he's, some sort of Soviet commissar who gets to tell the Ukrainians what kind of government they have. And who does he run off to? He runs off to meet with this the leader of this extremist anti-Semitic party, who I was reading up on them, and they wear T-shirts, saying something like "beat up Jews" and things like this, So here once again, just like when he went to Syria and met with a bunch of jihadis, he goes to Ukraine and meets with a bunch of skinheads and druggies, and it just shows how absurd the whole thing is.
Yeah, well, John McCain and. Well, let me ask you this. Is there actually the people out there protesting in the street? Is there an argument that you could credit to them other than, well, we just don't like the decision that was made here? Or are they saying that they were defrauded somehow or anything? What's their message that's so catchy that they got this many people out backing it? Because it's not just a rent a mob, right? They've recruited some young Democrats.
Yeah, but the U.S. has been financing the NGO sector in Ukraine for a long time, for a decade, and they continue to finance. They continue, if you look at USAID and everyone, they still spend millions of dollars a year propping up these NGOs. And so, well, perhaps they're not rent-a-mob. I often wonder who is paying the protesters to go ahead and sit in the middle of the square for 2 weeks. I mean, I don't know about you, Scott, but if I were to simply walk off my job for 2 weeks, I'd have a heck of a time paying the bills and eating. It makes you wonder where they are getting paid from and who is paying for them to sit out there endlessly.
And it sure does seem strange that this is the issue that's got them all rioting, right? Like in Brazil, it started as a protest over increased bus fares, price inflation, where it really hurts the poorest, the hardest. Right? Pretty easy explanation what's going on there. But and you can see how something like that could be hijacked too, of course. But in this case, they were upset about a marginal trade deal that wasn't actually going to trade their previous trade deal with the EU that they already had very much anyway. What? How's this a spark for anything?
It is pretty suspicious. And, Yanukovych is not... He's no sort of iron-fisted guy either. If anything, he's been kind of wimpy. Immediately after this thing, after the first week or so, he said, "Oh no, don't worry, guys. We're gonna go talk to the EU." He dispatched a team to Brussels. He wants to renegotiate. So it's not like he's sitting up there crossing his arms and sticking out his tongue. They probably wish he was a little bit more difficult to deal with. But if anything, he's proven pliant.
And now, what about that? Am I right about that this trade deal wasn't actually going to trade their current, change their current trade deal that much? I guess I heard NPR lady saying that, so I shouldn't take that to the bank, but she sort of seemed to be conceding it, that, this is actually not that big of a change of policy one way or the other, really. Maybe just in a symbolic way, because it's about whether to lean west or east?
Yeah, I think that has a lot to do with it. Starting the process... And, it's starting to, and it's also starting to suck Ukraine deeper and deeper into the IMF web. Here, take out a bunch more loans, guys. That's what you need. That'll help.
You can buy some Lockheed products with them.
That's a good point. And actually, we're about to put this up, but one of our board members who I admire enormously, Dennis Kucinich, wrote a great piece on what's this going to mean. What they really want is NATO membership for Ukraine, so they can start selling them a bunch of garbage they don't need, and stirring up arguments and fights that they don't need to have. So,
Right.
You know, that's certainly something to consider.
Yeah. Well, and that's certainly been a Lockheed project all along, right? Bruce Jackson from Lockheed created a committee on NATO expansion where it was just the committee on coming up with excuses for NATO expansion. That's all it was back in the 1990s.
Absolutely.
Get all these guys on the F-16 dole.
Yeah, and what's it done for any of these countries? I mean, it's given jobs to people like Radek Sikorsky, who, you know, not that long ago was haunting the halls of AEI in Washington as just another neocon, and now he's, what, foreign minister of Poland. He's down there marching in Kiev. He's screaming at the Ukrainians that they better do this and that and the other. He sounds just like an old Soviet apparatchik, you know. It's incredible how intolerable these EU bureaucrats are.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I remember Pat Buchanan once asked hypothetically, and I'm afraid of this hypothetical, honestly, but he said, you know what? What if angry right-winger came to power in Russia and decided they want to take some old territories back? Are we really going to give up all our major cities to fight? Yeah. You know, I mean, that's what NATO membership ostensibly means, is that an attack on Kiev is an attack on D.C., but really, I thought an attack on Kiev is a tragedy, but not an attack on D.C.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. No, you're right. I mean, and that's the ridiculousness of it. And I think if it came down to it, you know, we probably wouldn't do it because it is insane and stupid. Although we seem to be getting closer in China. It has nothing to do with NATO, but we're certainly, you know, there are plenty of provocations between Japan and China, and we seem to be wading into those waters too. So who knows? I mean, interventionism is a virus, you know, it's a disease. These people need to take a 12-step program or something.
Right. Yeah, did you see they had naval warships, American and Chinese warships, had a close call. These klutzes out there, with all their high-tech gear and their zillion-dollar radar systems. Whoa, hard maneuvers to the port side, Captain, and all this and that. And they almost crashed. And I don't know if that would have led directly to a war or something like that. But actually, something like that could well be misinterpreted, you know, on one side or the other. Or for political reasons, twisted, you know.
We'd rather have close encounters between U.S. and Chinese businessmen, you know. That's something that produces something that we all want and like, you know, products and commerce and jobs. I mean,
yeah, and let them provide their own security out there on the high seas.
Exactly.
They're making money.
That's a good point. You're right.
Kick American shipping off of the security dole. We don't need a U.S. Navy anymore. Not on the Chinese coast or the American one either. All right. Well, maybe that's just me. Thanks, Dan.
Thanks. Take care.
Appreciate it. That's Dan McAdams, everybody. He's running the Ron Paul Institute over there at, man, I'm clicking on my Ron Paul section. You know what it is, ronpaulinstitute.org. See y'all tomorrow. Thanks for listening. ScottHorton.org.